Welcome to the court today. We have only one case on our morning docket for oral argument. Letitia Blau versus State of Texas. And I believe we have Mr. Henderson for the appellant and Mark Kratovil, is that correct? Kratovil, okay. Sorry about that pronouncement. With me today is Justice Sue Walker to my right, and to my left is Justice Bonnie Suttereth, and we welcome our visitors today in court. I understand you all have checked in and stated your time for argument this morning, so if you're ready to begin, we will proceed with Mr. Henderson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As I was preparing this case, I really did think about the late Dixon Holman. There was a seminar on oral argument, effective advocacy in the court. And of course, the usual things: don't read your brief, don't argue every issue that you have, and et cetera. And then when they opened for questions, I said, Justice Holman, have you ever had a case where oral argument affected the direct outcome of a case? And he paused and looked up and said, I don't think so. So that said, I said, why are we here for oral argument? I think oral argument is a place where we get a full and fair airing of the issues. We're not some kind of debate, certainly not a presidential debate. We're here to talk about the legal issues in a calm and deliberate manner. This case involves a very tragic and sordid set of facts. And there's no doubt that Letitia Blau's daughter was sexually abused by co-defendant Thomas Crick. I suspect in that trial there was quite a bit of emotion going on, perhaps even tears shed by anyone participating or observing. As a human being, when I read the record, it affects me emotionally. I'm not going to tell you that it doesn't. But as lawyers, we have to step back and determine whether Letitia Blau received a fair trial and if the law was applied correctly in her case, and whether she is guilty as a party of sexual assault, continuing sexual assault of a child. There may be some nuances that she's perhaps a direct participant, but I think even in the record, which I cited in my brief and quoted, the parties to the case in open court said, this is the heart of the matter, is there sufficient evidence to convict her as a party? I won't go over in detail the facts. It appears from the record that after a meeting with Thomas Crick on what I call the first occasion, the family returned home, and Letitia tells her daughter to pack her bags. Oddly enough, it is one Junita France, the victim's daughter and mother, who actually picks her up and takes her over to her son's house, Thomas Crick. Upon return the next morning, Letitia specifically asked her daughter if she was molested, and she denied it. And there's all kinds of other details. She apparently began smoking methamphetamine with him, taking a morning after pill. She started calling him Dad. She wrote TLC or Thomas on her wrist with a marks a lot, or I guess they call them today, magic markers, whatever they call it. When she's tested at Cook, she tests positive for chlamydia. We know the facts are bad, especially as involving Crick. But issue one is perhaps the heart of the case, and I think if you can probably tell, many of the issues overlap each other. First thing that happens is the legal sufficiency. There are two ways that were submitted to a jury, what we'd call the traditional party, where you aid, abet, encourage, whatever, which we usually think of as the getaway driver. And the second theory that was put forth was a legal duty allegedly created, there is a duty under the family code. Whether or not that can be applied as a criminal statute, we argue also in a separate issue. But the two theories are really different of sufficiency. And obviously 702A, 2 and 3 are the where they get the party language. In her statement, she says she harbored a suspicion, but she would ask her daughter if anything going on that shouldn't be going on when you get over there. And she denies it every time. In the motion to quash, which is our second issue, trial counsel said, how can somebody know what we're defending against? You allege two or more sex acts have been committed more than 30 days apart. But if you're being charged as a party, how do you know which and what sex act to defend against? How do you say, well, no, that particular date couldn't have happened? Basically, the theory is she starts going over there, I think it is in September, and I believe the last time she was there was like November or December. And even though she denies it at first, later on at trial, she says, I was having sex with him every time I went over there. And so in order to convict Leticia, you have to show that she, beyond a reasonable doubt, some way participated knowingly and intentionally as a party to continuing sexual assault of a child. The state cited a case of Guevara, which is a murder case where the defendant was convicted as a party where he taught his mistress how to shoot a gun. She shoots the guy's wife and she collects a life insurance policy. They also cited Simon versus State, which stands for the proposition that a mother in that particular incident or that particular case is having sex with the defendant, and they apparently he starts having sex with her 15-year-old daughter while she watches. Well, I mean, that's a totally different set of facts than what happened here. She's simply picked up and taken over there. You might presume, you might think, well, she should have known. The penal code starts talking about, I mean, the family code about a duty to prevent something like that happening. But is that enough to apply it to a criminal statute and convict somebody of this crime, which is continuing sexual assault of a child? We also cited 103 of the penal code, which basically says that unless something is defined as a crime, it cannot be a crime. There is some other language subsequent in the penal code that says there can be other statutes that are not in this penal code. But our objection is the family code, which says that a person has a duty to protect, I believe it's protect, discipline a child and protect them from being abused. We'd say that that is not exactly a penal statute. Certainly parents do have that duty, but is that enough to put that language into a party's charge or a jury's charge?
Setting aside the fact that she was the mother, what would her legal duty have been? Because it envisions a duty, and you can't just let the jury imagine or glean a jury out of thin air, a duty out of thin air. So what would you say the legal duty is, if not the duty to protect and discipline the child that a parent has?
Oh, I guess if she wasn't a parent, maybe the family code wouldn't apply. I hadn't thought of that, Justice. But in this particular case, they said because she is a parent, we do have this sort of omnibus duty to protect a child, and the 151 of the family code, since she is the mother and she is a parent, that we will apply it as a criminal statute. And interestingly enough, we mentioned later on in our brief about, I think it's error 7 or 8, where, and this is an issue that's been going on for a long time, if you have two different theories of a case and six jurors think it's one way and six think it's another, well, that's good enough to convict somebody. But here you're really stretching that. Here you're saying, you know, she should have known that she made a deal with Thomas Crick to provide her daughter for sex so that she could get drugs and perhaps some money. And the other theory is this totally different theory out of the penal code. And you first have to say, is there sufficient evidence under either theory to convict for a sufficiency case? And then you have to determine whether or not there's been due process applied when the jurors are given the choice of which theory they want to convict her under. One of the other issues that it came up, and the state has said that when the defense objected to the definition of indecency, that they waived it because they didn't bring it up until the jury charge conference. Well, that's the first place that they decided that they were going to use this language in the charge conference. And at the same time, there was a request, as far as the charge is concerned, for a lesser included offense. So you have language that's put in the charge that's not in the indictment on not only the definition of sexual indecency with the child and this duty under the family code, which are not in the indictment. If somebody's going to start putting that kind of language, or a judge is going to start putting that language in a jury charge, perhaps that's the first time you're able to raise the issue. I mean, the defense did the best job they could by moving to quash the entire indictment for lack of good notice. And then when you finally get to the jury charge, they're throwing in things that's not in the indictment. And I think issue eight perhaps deserves more focus than I originally thought. The defense asked for a lesser included offense. And if the jury believed there was just one time, or that it was just indecency, then it's essentially a lesser included offense because ag sex assault of a child is a first degree felony that carries 5 to 99 with the possibility of parole. Some forms of indecency with a child are second degree felonies that carry 2 to 20 years. And the state has been accurate if there's evidence. You can only give a charge for lesser included if there's evidence of a lesser included. And under that theory, it was all or nothing. Either you believe she was abused multiple times, and the jury was not able to consider the fact that maybe that first time or maybe that second time, that's the only one they've proved beyond a reasonable doubt. when the defense asked for that particular lesser included offense charge, they were denied.
But what evidence would point to that proposition that it only happened once?
Well, the first event, I think, or the first time she went over there, possibly. Girl comes back and says nothing happened. So mom keeps letting her go over there. So maybe the jury could have said, you know, she cut the deal the first time, but then nothing happened, so she just kept going over there. And you can speculate whether the mom knew or should have known. But right there, we would argue that's evidence, maybe just the bare scintilla of evidence, that it happened just one time. And if it happened just one time, we've got a different punishment range. Continuing sexual assault of a child is 25 to life. So.
But wouldn't that really show that maybe there was no offense that time, but there were all these other visits over the three-month period?
Well, our fallback is, sorry, the allergies are getting to me. The fallback, our number one position is there's not sufficient evidence to convict him, to convict her of anything as a party. But we would argue that at least the jury should have been able to consider that maybe we think a lot of this happened, but we really aren't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened more than once.
The complainant's testimony, wasn't it, though, that every time she went over there, it happened?
That's correct, but she continued to deny to her mother that mm-hmm. it happened. And so there was yes. never any of this discussion. You're going over there to have sex that could be imputed to mom to know that. So my time is about up. We request and pray for reversal and acquittal and reversal, or optionally reversal and remand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. The state is ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Cradiville, here representing the state of Texas today, and I will start off by acknowledging something that I said in the outset of the briefing, and that's that there is something novel and unique about this case, because in my research and preparing both the brief and for oral arguments here today, I failed to find any appellate cases in Texas where somebody has been convicted or charged as a party for continuous sexual abuse of a child. And that being said, it's not completely out of the blue, because there are a few cases I cited and that appellate counsel has referred to in my brief where people have been charged as a party for similar crimes, typically crimes of violence. And with that being said, it doesn't stretch the imagination to understand how this charge as a party came to be. And in regards to the sufficiency point of error, I would contend that the appellant's own statement, specifically the second interview she gave to Detective Person in the Mansfield City Jail, itself is sufficient evidence to affirm the conviction on that point of error, without even going into any other portions of the record. She makes an affirmative statement in that interview that she was receiving drugs and money for sending her child over there, and that she continued to harbor an ongoing concern that there were molestation or sexual assaults occurring when she went over there. And so, at best, what we have here is that the appellant had willful ignorance of what was going on. She confirmed that it was always a concern of hers, and that it kept being a concern of hers the entire time. And I think the audio interview there speaks for itself in terms of confirming that she had that ongoing concern. Also, I would point out to the court that a defendant or an appellant's implausible explanations is something that a jury can take into account and can be evidence in support of a conviction. And her explanations for why she was sending her daughter over to Thomas Crick's house is just that. It's implausible. And I believe that was shown to be the case at trial, and the jury agreed with that explanation. This court has considered a similar case before with continuous sexual abuse of a child, and Justice Walker, you wrote the opinion in this case in Pollock back in 2013, and a number of the two specific points of error that the appellant has brought up were rejected in that case, and so I would encourage the court to refer back to that opinion in response to the appellant's motion to quash argument, as well as the non-unanimous jury verdict argument as well. So I think Pollock is dispositive at least two of these points of error. In regards to the party theory of liability that occurred here, as appellate counsel has noted, there are two theories at play here. We've got our traditional party liability, that's 702A2, and then we've got our legal duty theory of party liability, that's A3 under the same statute. And what is interesting here is the necessity of reaching into the family code for finding a definition of what a legal duty is. And Justice Sutterth, as you pointed out, it's necessary in this instance to define legal duty in the jury charge. Otherwise, you'll have jurors just trying to pick out of thin air what precisely that means. And indeed, there is some authority to show that if you don't put in the legal duty language here of a parent, that in and of itself is error on the part of the trial court. And so We may well have been here litigating the same issue.
She wasn't tried as a parent. She was tried as a party. And so my question really is, should the if there's something wrong with the legal duty definition that was given because it related to a parent, what is the legal duty of a party? What would the legal duty have been for that driver that was driving that girl over there every day or every time she went?
I don't know necessarily that in that, under the facts of this case, that the driver there would have had a legal duty. I'm not sure that would have been the case. And if you're asking me what crime we could have charged her with, mm-hmm. the driver, we could probably come up with a couple. She might have been a party under 702A2, just the traditional party liability, but not necessarily under A3. Just because I can't imagine off the top of my head what her legal duty would have been. I don't know that she necessarily would have had one. There's a common theme.
So only parents can be charged with this?
Well, no, not necessarily just parents. Certainly not. But if you can point me to another party that would have a legal duty to prevent this offense from occurring, then I would say that under 702A3, you could absolutely charge them. The only one I'm aware of, and the only one that's directly applicable to this case, is for a parent. They have a statutory legal duty to prevent harm to their child that's spelled out by the family code. And even taking that out, however, she still could have been convicted under the A2 party liability, because even if she didn't have direct knowledge of the criminality of what was occurring, the penal code doesn't allow willful ignorance to be an excuse. Just like in a case of felony murder, if you have two defendants go into a convenience store, one is a lookout and one is the person with a gun who goes up to rob the clerk, the shooter ends up killing the clerk. The lookout is just as liable for felony murder there, even though they did not know that the co-defendant was going to go in and commit that action. They can't hide behind willful ignorance of the criminal intent of their co-defendant. And that same theory, I think, is applicable under the circumstances of this case. And if the court has any particular areas of concern that it would like me to address, I'm more than happy to do so. There are some interesting legal issues at play here. I would rest on the merits of my brief if the court has no further questions, and yield the rest of my time.
I would like you to expand on your response to the sufficiency of the notice as to the indictment and the charge.
And in particular, are you referring to the indecency
language? Yeah, it was. Let me see if I can pick out which point it was. It was the second point.
Point of error number two?
Yes.
Well, sure. We'll just start off with the general proposition that if you track the statutory language, that's sufficient notice. And then the sort of fallback argument here is that even if there is something wrong with the indictment, which I'm not conceding that point, to be clear, but even if there is something wrong with the indictment's notice here, the indictment doesn't necessarily stand by itself. There are other portions of the record that would serve to provide the appellant with sufficient notice as to what precisely she is defending against. And in this case, we have a transcribed interview with the appellant, or I'm sorry, with the complainant, where the complainant details to a forensic interviewer what precisely she's alleging occurred. And I cite to a case in this, my response to this point of error, from the Court of Criminal Appeals that shows if you have other pieces of discovery that are shown to the defense, even if there's a problem with the indictment can be saved with that further discovery. So we have not only the complainant's forensic interview. We also have outcry statements from members of the complainant's family who add some further detail onto what they allege is occurring. And the continuous sexual abuse of a child statute here is rather unique, 2102, in that it sort of cannibalizes other portions of the penal code by saying that you can allege that continuous sexual abuse of a child occurred by alleging these other crimes, and one of which is indecency. And that's precisely what occurred here. The indictment alleged indecency in a number of different manners and means, and then it also alleged sexual assault in there. And 2102 specifies that that's a permissible way to go about giving notice. So even though there might not have been in the indictment great specificity as to the specific acts alleged that the state is relying on, that's not what 2102 requires. It just requires stating that this occurred, these alleged acts occurred over a period of greater than 30 days, and the nature of what those underlying offenses are. And so the indictment in this case did allege that, and as I point out in the brief as well, there have been some other cases where this argument has been made that the acts relied upon were not specific enough in the indictment. And other courts of appeals, I believe the El Paso Court of Appeals is one, has previously ruled that for continuous sexual abuse of a child, you do not need to specify in the indictment the specific dates that those acts occurred on. So there is some precedent that this court can rely on from other courts of appeals that 2102 doesn't require incredibly specific dates to satisfy the notice requirement. But even if that is a problem here, we still have other discovery that satisfies the notice requirement. So this just wasn't something that the appellant would have been completely surprised by in preparing for trial. And if the court has no other questions, I'll yield the rest of my time and ask the court to affirm the conviction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Henderson, rebuttal.
That this is a case of first impression is probably true. I don't know if there is another one. I just hope there never is another one like this case. As far as the statements are concerned, you will have to listen to those because they were not transcribed. They are somewhat lengthy. There are two, just for your edification. One is taken when she's first taken to the police station. I think it was in White Settlement, and she gives a non-custodial statement, and then later on they go out to the Mansfield City Jail, which the Fort Worth Police is still using as their city jail, and she is questioned there by the White Settlement detective. I would disagree with counsel that she actually makes just overt omissions, but I leave it to the court to listen to what she said and just make your own decision. Pollock did come out of this court, and what I would distinguish on Pollock, that was the case where the defendant complained that he wasn't given specific enough dates and times to defend against his continuing sexual assault of a child. I would point out there's a very distinct difference between Pollock and this case. In that case, Pollock was the perpetrator. He was the guy committing the sexual assault, the continuing sexual assault of a child. So he's the guy that should know how many times or what he did. This is very different when you're trying to convict Letitia Blyle as a party. The legal duty of Janita France, something I have thought about. It's outside the record, but I've even talked to the prosecutors that were there and curious, why didn't she get charged? I don't know. But it seems like I just hadn't really thought about if she had been tried, if they could have put that family code provision in there. I don't think they could. I just don't know. And really intellectually worked that one out in my head. I would point out the record is long, sometimes kind of difficult to read. I think there was one point where Wes Ball, the defense attorney, made an objection, and then he and Judge Wish engaged in a dialogue, I think, that went on for 16 pages before there's finally a ruling on the objection. So it's a rather tedious record to listen to. But obviously, with a sufficiency of evidence complaint, you're going to have to listen to it. And there's one other case I wanted to distinguish or talk about. The state did mention Moff versus State, where a person was convicted of continuing financial transactions, and there was a distinguishing reference in their brief to the fact that that was financial and some of them were legal transactions, and not all of them necessarily were illegal transactions, and went on for a number of years. And here, it only went on for 3 or 4 months. Well, I would say the cases are basically the same in some ways. You may very well conclude that there were times she just went over there and watched television and didn't have sex, though she says she had sex every time. But the question is that still enough to impute legal criminal liability to Letitia Blau in this particular case? I appreciate your attention, and we rely on our opinion.
Thank you. We appreciate all of your briefing, and we appreciate you coming to oral argument today. Your case is now submitted, and having no more cases this morning, on this morning's docket, we will now adjourn court. Thank you.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned. You're dismissed.